This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
You're listening to Chicanismo, Pachuco Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Got a healthy serving of some real grassroots organizing last March and early this month over what some have called the harshest immigration bill within the last 70 years. The Sensenbrenner bill, H.R. 4437, passed the House in December of 2005 and entered the Senate Judiciary early March, sparking protest all over the country. Not since the Chicano civil rights movement during the 60s has the country seen such mobilization from the Latino community. Within the last few weeks, we've seen record turnouts in cities across the country. Chicago led the way on March 10th with a turnout of over 100,000 people in what was at the time the largest pro-immigrant rally the country had ever seen. Weeks later, Los Angeles flooded the streets with anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people, and on the same day, other record-breaking rallies filled downtowns in cities like Phoenix, Arizona, Denver, Colorado, and Atlanta, Georgia. On Monday, April 10th, the National Day of Protest, over 130 cities and towns in the country rallied in favor of fair immigration laws and a pathway to citizenship for those who have worked long and hard in this country without a chance to become citizens. We're seeing a surge of support from areas of our community that we haven't seen in the past. Immigrants are leaving work to march courageously in the streets alongside our youth who have staged walkouts in Los Angeles and even here in Woodburn and Portland, Oregon. Some immigrants have returned to their jobs only to be fired, while youth risk suspension from school to speak out against these injustices. Commercial news outlets divert attention by debating whether teenagers should be punished for leaving school, while overlooking the fact that our youth empower and educate themselves through this active struggle, participating in healthy democratic protest. In the spirit of the Brown Berets and the United Mexican American Students, or UMAS, of the late 60s, they are making history. I would also like to take out a moment to send my thoughts and prayers to Anthony Soltero, a 14-year-old youth who took his own life after taking part in the recent LA walkout. According to his family, the school's vice principal threatened Soltero that he could be sent to jail for 3 years for missing class because of the immigration protest. With organizations putting their heads together and with huge pro-immigrant rallies popping up all over the country, our senators are rethinking how to piece together reform on immigration. As of the 12th of this month, Republicans are calling for removal of language in the current legislation that would make undocumented immigration a felony. A recent Washington Post ABC poll showed only 20% of U.S. residents support measures such as this. This is still a far cry from a just policy. The immigrant voice has still been severed from the discussion. And although H.R. 4437 has a pretty obvious target of Mexican and Latino immigrants coming into this country. Latinos aren't the only ones who should be concerned. This legislation is so broad that it would criminalize anyone who offers any kind of assistance to undocumented immigrants in this country, such as family members, friends, legal experts, church organizers, and employers, most of whom were born here. With this broad language, the interpretation is left wide open, so this could criminalize just about anyone. I had a chance to speak with organizers from Phoenix, Arizona, Los Angeles, and here in Oregon, where Salem turned out over 20,000 people in support of immigrant rights. Here's Erica Steinbauer, organizer for CAUSA here in Oregon at our state capitol on Sunday the 9th.
We called this rally here today in Salem to call for a just legalization and comprehensive immigration reform that reflects our principles, including providing a path to citizenship for the 12 million undocumented, reunifying families, protecting workers, and protecting our civil rights and civil liberties.
On the overall significance of this movement.
Well, I think that what you're seeing and what we have been seeing in the last few weeks is a people-led movement that's been sweeping the country. Just a few weeks ago, the only thing on the table was the Sensenbrenner bill, which would criminalize all undocumented people and the people who serve them. And since some massive mobilizations in D.C., L.A., Chicago, we had one in Portland at the beginning of March, we've been pushing back. And the Senate had been considering, although still not sufficient, a more moderate proposal that didn't include a pathway to citizenship. And so we just need to keep up the momentum and keep telling Congress that it's unacceptable to punish the hardworking people that put food on the table, and instead you need to provide a path to citizenship.
Ramon Ramirez, lead organizer with Picun, said this was by far the biggest rally he had ever seen at Oregon State Capitol. Phoenix, Arizona had two of the largest rallies that the city has ever seen, with over 20,000 people participating on March 24th and over 100,000 on April 10th. Lydia Hernandez, organizer for Somos America campaign and the Coalition for Latino Political Action, had this to say.
We were, ourselves, we were involved in a national, with a national level, the Center for Community Change, that was helping us to keep us abreast not only of what was going on or what was not happening or what needed to happen, but was giving us directly that information and was able to come to Arizona to help us educate our groups. I mean, we developed a message. We worked with the 45 organizations that came together in terms of that message and explaining, helping decipher what was going on that helped educate us in Arizona in terms of what was going on in Washington. We were able, again, with the help of the CCC, we're able to develop a media strategy in terms of where we had a consistent message and work with different groups. We had media trainings, but that was key in getting the people out. That's why you saw the more structured organization happening and also quadrupling our numbers. What helps, I think, is that we were able to form a coalition, I mean, quickly. We were able to get 45 organizations to come to the table that had not been playing, you know, in the same sandbox before, which was great. To us, the great success was that in itself.
Why did this affect so many people?
The urgency. The fact that our base members, our organizational space were, I mean, their backs are against the wall. There's, in light of what's happening at the state level as well as the national level, there's no hope. I mean, you're being pushed deeper into that shadow. So it's an opportunity for people wanting to come out. I mean, they've got nothing left to lose, right? Because they're losing their rights left and right.
On the diversity of the crowd and organizations involved.
We had African-American, Arabs, Muslim religion background. It was the first time this type of group comes together along with the immigrants and different Latino organizations. Labor and church groups as well. And you saw that reflected at our speakers panel. At the Capitol rally at the end of the march. We had Unite Here. We had SEIU play a major role, brought in resources and some money to help us, you know, put this together. We saw the African-American community, different groups. I mean, we had the Greater Phoenix Urban League. We had the National Action Network. We had, you know, African-American leaders. We had the four Asian groups presidents participate. I mean, we had, and you could see it in our people that were marching as well for the first time. It was just, it was extraordinary. I mean, it was dynamic. And the way they kind of, they worked together on the stage was great as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you figure these people have known each other and have been working together for a long time. But it just happened that way, so.
Local officials and agency response.
You know, it was great. We prior to the march, we had received a call from the Arizona Education Association. I mean, we had volunteers calling up and saying, "Look, we our organization, our association wants to show up. What can we do to help?" There were all kinds of calls being made prior to that march. I think it just added. Again, we had all kinds of not only different. Backgrounds of people, but also different organizations or associations that we never thought, you know, were state employees. The governor had let people, staff go at half day and was urging and encouraging their participation in the march. If I hadn't seen the actual note myself, that was in the memo, I wouldn't have believed it. But not only was the state government very well and easily to work with, all the departments had came together and in terms of making this a safer march. We saw that in their participation, but the mayor was phenomenal. He was great. He met with us. He was thinking with us, kind of brainstorming what we needed to cover to make sure that it was safe.
Moving forward.
There's a lot of discussion right now. We're kind of, everybody's wanting to take some time to reflect. Reflect on what our next steps are, whether we had an impact at Congress. But there's a lot of our organizations that are already committed to doing voter registrations, that are committed to getting the vote out, to impact the November elections. There's a feeling of urgency where our people's backs are against the wall, and you've got no other recourse. That is the only recourse. That's when we jumped at the opportunity and took advantage of the momentum that's going on nationwide and tapped into that national message to say, you know, we want to help it, and we want to do our piece in Arizona, and we want to be engaged in what you're doing nationwide to help that apply that political pressure. What can we do? So we started bringing everybody together. And again, it wasn't as easy and clean to do, but it worked out. We had all 45 organizations, you know, valuing what everybody was bringing in, and for the first time, we're working with the Center for Community Change. And I would urge everybody, in terms of the national conversation, please get involved, because I think it's got to be a united effort all across the U.S. And nothing's going to build us up, or it's got to be a collective effort. And so please log on to that www.april10th.org website. All the reports, we're asking everybody to post their reports in terms of the numbers that went out, the details, so that we all know what each other did. But most importantly, we've got to decide on the next steps, and they need to get involved in that conversation. So to contact the Center for Community Change as well, get on their website as well, and tap into that, because it's great to hear. It keeps the energy flowing. But you know how many heads are coming together? I mean, we could be developed that more creative message together.
It's a mighty long road that my poor hands have hold. My poor feet have traveled a long dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. Your deserts was hot. And the mountains was cold. I worked on your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground by the light of your moon. At the edge of your cities you will see us, and then we come with the dust and we're gone with the wind. California, Arizona, I made all your crops, but it's north up to Oregon to harvest your hops. Dig the beers from the ground, pick the grapes from your vines to set on your table, your light sparkling white. America the free. Who are your ancestors? What is your creed? Who is
liberty. When did you come to America? Long, long before, when the buffalo won. When did your hands burn like gold? The thing that made this land your pride and your joy. When did you come to America?
The Los Angeles voice probably spoke loudest when on April 10th, anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people showed up to support immigrants in our communities. Here's the LA perspective from Marquise Harris Dawson, Executive Director of Community Coalition in South Los Angeles.
You know, this is really a true people's movement, a true working people's movement. You know, a lot of it came through the radio stations in the morning and in the afternoon, both in English and Spanish. We're talking about the proposed law. Young people were using MySpace and chat rooms and email to distribute. Organizations were definitely contacting their base and their membership and churches and civic groups and sports teams and high school students. It was just a really snowballing of interest by people who probably wouldn't normally be involved in this type of thing. When they heard about how grotesque and how inhumane the proposal was, everybody wanted to be involved in standing up against it. For years, the Community Coalition has worked with CARESEN, the Central American Resource Center, with CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, numbers of block clubs and neighborhood councils and other community organizations that fight for social justice on a range of issues. All of us saw this and thought that it was important to take a pause from what we were working on to confront this law.
Marquise on why so many people came out to support this pro-immigrant movement.
Well, I think it's just the outright affront. It is so incredibly offensive and inhumane to say that people who were called to work here, because it's not as if large companies do not put out the call to other countries for, you know, that there's work in the United States. And people who are called to come here, you're going to, after you've been exploiting them for years and years and years, using the cheap labor, and you've built an economy largely on their backs, then you're going to turn around and say that they're a felon and their grandparents are felons, and we're going to put you in jail definitely and not give you the basic rights that any human being, regardless of what papers they have or don't have, should be treated in a humane and just way. And so the fact that this law was so brazen in its approach and proposed to essentially put people in jail for seeking a job, many people thought that that was, you know, enough is enough, and we've got to confront this.
Other reactions.
Here in Los Angeles, people have been supportive. Almost, you know, every elected official of note has come out against the Sensenberger bill and the school board and the County of Los Angeles. Everybody has been clear that this is bad news and have called for sensible immigration policy in California and throughout the United States. And so we fortunately don't live in the part of the country where people are supportive of this type of measure.
Just like in Arizona, LA too had diverse rallies.
I know that there was a huge Latin American presence at the rally, but certainly a fair amount of folks from various Asian countries, some of the Middle East, as well as Africa and the Caribbean.
Moving forward.
Well, you know, I think this administration and the Republican, the one-party rule that we have in the United States has absolutely created miserable conditions for people in all walks of life, especially working people. And so we won't be surprised if we see, we're expecting a big rally here in Los Angeles on May Day, on May 1st. Certainly prison reform is a big issue in Latino and African-American communities throughout the country. The again, very right-wing elements and reactionary elements like Newt Gingrich, even they're calling for an end to the war in Iraq and want our children brought home from both Afghanistan and Iraq.
Including immigrants.
So I think we have the potential to have a long, hot summer, not only in Los Angeles, but throughout the country.
On the 17th of this month, Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue signed the Georgia Security and Immigration Compliance Act, a law that will deny many state services paid for by taxpayers to people who are in the United States without documentation. Taxpayers such as immigrants themselves, who contribute an estimated $200 million in state and local taxes there in Georgia. It also forces contractors doing business with the state to verify the legal status of new workers and requires police to notify immigration officials if people charged with the crimes are illegal immigrants. Scapegoating our immigrant community solves nothing. Ask yourself why immigrants come to this country. The United States has carried out a brutal foreign policy for decades and has left many countries, especially Central and South American countries, in economic turmoil by a free trade and military operations that have placed brutal dictators into power and displaced thousands of families. The, quote, industrialization of these countries squeezed small farmers out of businesses and off their own land, leaving people in utter poverty. Is it a surprise that people risk crossing the border just to feed their families? I think you would do the same. No one wants to work long, hard hours with low or no wages, without benefits or breaks for that matter. These are people that we depend on, who are being abused in the process. The arguments and weak framework on immigrants soaking up our resources here in America and on terrorism? If that's the real concern, then let's pull our troops out of Iraq so we can place the billions of wasted dollars back into our communities and stop contributing to terrorism by destroying communities abroad. On that note, I think I'll conclude this segment with an announcement of the next rally in Oregon on our state capitol. Oregon works because immigrants work. On May 1st, 1 p.m. Also, call your senators and let them know that we want respect for human rights. For more info, log on to my website at www.chucoradio.com. That's chucoradio.com. And prepare to rally once again on May 1st at our state capitol in Salem. For other events around the country, go to www.april10.org.
Present Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman will be speaking this coming Saturday afternoon at 1:30 p.m. at the Hilton Hotel in downtown Portland as a featured guest of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Her talk will focus on independent media in a time of war and has been open to the public. Please note, there are a limited number of seats available, and this event is expected to fill quickly. Seats will be on sale the day of the event on a strictly first-come, first-served basis with no advance ticket sales. Admission will be on a sliding scale of $5 to $20. That's Amy Goodman this Saturday, April 22nd at 1:30 p.m. The Hilton Hotel, downtown Portland, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue. This event is a benefit for KBOO Radio.
And good morning. This is a Thursday morning radio zine for Thursday, April 20th. Coming up next, Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Missal. And at 10, it's a pilot program of anti-war poetry called Roadside Bomb. They'll focus on the parallels between World War I and the Iraq War. At 10:30, Julie Bernard hosts Art Focus. Her guest is Brian Costello of PICA. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear about a lawsuit filed by the families of four private security contractors killed in Fallujah in March 2004. They are charging Blackwater USA with fraud and wrongful death. All that coming up next on KBOO. But right now it's time for Press Watch. Kay Teresa, you just have to bear with me. I've got to cue up your theme. I don't suppose you know where it is.
Okay, that's to the theme.
Oh, I love that theme. I have to play it. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Here it is. We couldn't live without it.
It's 9:30, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. And I just want to say thanks to all those of you who helped us out with the membership drive. It was a struggle, and we got it done. And I'm so proud of the greater KBOO community, which now stretches apparently all over the globe. And I want to thank you for helping out and keeping us going with our little effort here to do a radio station that's relevant and has to do with our community instead of having to do with corporate profits. And today on Press Watch, I've got a couple of topics. I want to talk about Halliburton's detention centers and some detention that's going on right now, which one might characterize as slavery. And it's happening right now in the United States, and you may have heard something about it on Democracy Now! When Amy Goodman was earlier this month in New Orleans. And we'll follow up on that. But first, I want to talk about theocracy. From ABC News, two American archbishops involved in the response to the clergy sex abuse scandals. One praised for his efforts to heal wounds in the Boston Archdiocese, and the other now overseeing worldwide abuse claims, were among 15 men named cardinals Wednesday by Pope Benedict XVI. Now, that's Johnny Ratzinger, who I've always referred to as Johnny DeRat since I caught him, or I didn't catch him. I caught the news stories of him interfering with U.S. elections. But anyway, returning to the text, Sean O'Malley, 61, became Archbishop in Boston 3 years ago after Cardinal Bernard Law, who's still Cardinal, was pressured to resign over his handling of priest abuse allegations. William LaVeda, who I refer to as Darth LaVeda, had been spiritual leader for Catholics in Portland, Oregon from 86 to 95 and then in San Francisco until last year when he was named to the most influential Vatican post ever held by an American prefect. And that was a position last held by the current pope. At the Vatican, LaVeda's role includes, get this, reviewing abuse allegations against priests worldwide. Priest abuse victims had criticized the appointment last year, saying LaVeda had done a poor job dealing with the abuse crisis at home. The Survivors Network of those abused by priests said that he was slow to act, harsh to victims, and committed to secrecy in responding to molestation claims. So that's part of the update on one of the most powerful institutions in the United States. The Archdiocese of San Francisco has agreed to pay more than $16 million to settle a dozen lawsuits alleging sexual abuse by a once popular priest. Attorneys announced the agreements days before the first of several planned trials, that was earlier this year, that were to begin with plaintiffs alleging they were abused by the late Reverend Joseph Pritchard. Settlement works out to an average of $1.3 million for each plaintiff. Now, to get this, when I use the search engines, for example, when I use Google, which I would like to remind people is owned by the Carlyle Group, I could not pull up anything under LaVeda pedophile. I had to use LaVeda priest abuse. So you can't get right to the point. Good old Darth LaVeda. So on another front of the theocratic war on the United States, a Ten Commandments monument that has stood out on the courthouse lawn for almost 50 years does not promote religion and can remain in place, a federal judge ruled. U.S. District Judge James Carr said Tuesday that the monument can stay because the motives for placing it outside the Lucas County courthouse. Apparently that's in Ohio. We're secular and not an endorsement of a specific belief. The ACLU sued Lucas County in 2002 to have the display removed, saying it was unconstitutional and promoted religion. Let's see, Ten Commandments, religion, promoting religion by putting Ten Commandments. I wonder where they got that idea. Carr's decision followed a ruling last year by the U.S. Supreme Court that addressed displays of Ten Commandments. The Supreme Court in June allowed a 6-foot granite monument to remain at the Texas Capitol. Justices said the Ten Commandments exhibits would be upheld if their main purpose was to honor the nation's legal rather than religious traditions, and if they didn't promote one religious sect over another. Well, that's funny because I haven't seen any large granite monuments to the Eightfold Path or to the utterances of Muhammad. And maybe it's about time that we got some granite going on that. Wouldn't mind seeing some quotes from the Rig Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita, for that matter. And we can just put them right next to those Ten Commandments. I'm sure no one will mind since it doesn't have a religious purpose at all. It just happens to come from the dominant religion in the United States. Just one of those coincidences. And more on theocracy. This from L.A. Times. Cardinal Richard M. Mahoney acknowledged to Los Angeles Catholics in his 2004 report to the people of God that he left 5 priests in ministry despite complaints that they had molested children. But a Times analysis of church records released since then shows that he left 11 other priests in ministry for periods of up to 13 years after parishioners raised concerns about inappropriate behavior with children. 7 of these 11 cases were not detailed in the People of God report. The other 4 were mentioned incompletely. The report said they were removed when complaints were lodged but did not disclose that the Los Angeles Archdiocese had received earlier reports of misconduct. So, if you want your kids safe, my advice is get them the hell away from priests. Okay, so now I want to talk about detention, slavery, fascism, and the end of our society as we know it. And then we'll get down to heavier topics. No, actually, Halliburton. Well, let me read this article by Ruth Conniff. By the way, I'm going to want your comments. I haven't been able to do that for a while. So much news, but I need to back off and hear what people have got to say. The number to call if you have comments on Press Watch and comments on news you're not supposed to know and that sort of thing. The number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Ruth Conniff writes in The Progressive, while thousands of people were celebrating the contribution America's undocumented immigrants make to our economy and demanding justice and recognition for workers who are denied basic rights, the government was making plans for large-scale detention centers in case of an emergency influx of immigrants. KBR, the Halliburton subsidiary, recently reprimanded for gross overcharging in its military contracts in Iraq, won a $385 million contract to build the centers. Now, maybe you've heard about this. There is apparently very little news available on the web about it. This is what we know. $385 million to Halliburton, build detention centers, and that is for the existing ICE detention and removal operations program facilities. In the event of an emergency influx of immigrants, and I don't know why they think there would be an emergency influx of immigrants. I mean, there's a constant influx of immigrants for economic reasons. Or to support the rapid development of new programs. And, of course, that's the part that really gets your attention, isn't it? Because the first part is bogus, the second part is way too vague. Or to support the rapid development of new programs. Well, let's see what's going on. War is threatening. And this administration hates dissent more than any administration I've ever experienced. So Halliburton's building detention centers, and detention is going on right now. If you were listening to Democracy Now!, I think around April 8th, should have written down the date anyway, earlier this month, Phyllis Mann was talking with Amy Goodman, and in the context of that interview, she said, there are 35 facilities that we, meaning lawyers, are aware of all over the state of Louisiana, where over 8,500 people from Orleans jails were evacuated, and we're literally having to go in and meet with those people one by one to figure out when they got arrested, why they were in jail, whether they've been convicted or whether they were waiting for trial, whether it was a misdemeanor or a felony. The computers from the Orleans Parish Criminal sheriff's office, you like that, criminal sheriff's office, were retrieved from New Orleans, and their information technology people have been working to try to get as much information off the computers as possible. And eventually what will happen is they're going to start matching the information they can recover from the computers. And she also said, I would say a good half of them are not supposed to be in jail at all. They have served whatever sentence they've received and should be released, but until we can figure that out, they're still sitting there. And Amy Goodman responded, some haven't been sentenced at all. Phyllis Mann said, many of them not sentenced at all. Many of them not even convicted. They are people who, like all American citizens, when they're arrested, are presumed innocent until proven guilty and have had not even had an opportunity to go to court. And there's more on that. Now, a great number of these people apparently have been arrested for basically nothing, for begging, for playing an instrument without a permit, for not paying a traffic ticket. And there is an article on dollarsandcents.org, that's dollarsandcense.org, and it's all about the economic advantages of keeping people in jail without charge, making them work, and never letting them go. And if I have time, I'll pass that on as well. But right now I have a caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
I was listening to what you're talking about, the Kellogg Brown and Root contract for the concentration camps, the detention centers.
Yeah.
The FEMA centers, you're absolutely right. A little history, you probably know this. I don't know if your listeners do. You can trace this back to Rex 84, Readiness Exercise 84. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, that was a big thing, and I had the Christic Institute affidavit when I first came to KBOO.
Part of the continuity in government programs, which Cheney was congressman at the time, and Rumsfeld, a private CEO of a drug company. What a surprise.
Yeah, it's the
same, behind this.
Same operative.
J.D. Sterling Company. Anyway, if you look at that, and you're right, they planned for at the time, a mass immigration across our southern border, and they planned to detain 400,000 illegal aliens, if you will, crossing the border.
Because they had a war going on, and so at that time, at least, there was the sort of plausibility that if the war heated up even worse than it was, although that's kind of hard to imagine with the tactics the Contras were using, then people would just come flooding over the border.
Correct. Well, I'll tell you what I see, Teresa, happening in this, and this is something I've looked between the lines and I don't hear this discussed about. I see them, the elements of our government at the top, Bush obviously is part of this, they want to bring these people in here as a slave class. They want our borders open. They bring them in here. They have a slave class. When Bush says they do the jobs Americans don't want, no, that's not true. They can put these people who can't speak English in a job that would pay a fairly good wage. And what are they going to do if they're paid even below minimum wage? Nothing. They can't complain about it. They are creating an absolute slave class. They say we have to teach them in Spanish in school because it's easier to learn. Well, that's not true. It's true that if you don't speak English, you're not going to get a good job. I know a lot of Mexicans that live in my community that are good, hard-working people. That's what they're here for. They're being taken advantage of by a lot of contractors for cheap labor. They're being brought in by the millions, and Bush is behind this. Bush is not opposed to illegal immigration. He is promoting it the whole way around. Now, dovetailing that to your concentration camps, yeah, I think what you're going to see is a massive roundup here by the government of illegal immigration, illegal aliens, if you will. And the people are going to cheer that the government is good. They're behind this. But, you know, we're going to have a police state, suspend our constitution, give up our civil liberties. That's how we're going to round up the illegal aliens. Well, once they start that, you know who's next, you and I, and anybody that disagrees with the government.
Or simultaneously.
Absolutely. And also, too, Teresa, La Raza, if you look into that, it's funded by the Rockefeller, the Carnegie Foundation. They receive their money from rich white corporate conglomerates, if you will. If you look behind who's funding La Raza is not a friend of the Mexican worker. And they're being pushed into the streets. It reminds me of Kent State. You've got these large front organizations, La Raza, Micha, pushing the illegal immigrants into the streets, pushing a conflict between U.S. citizens and illegal immigrants. It's fake. It's false. Why? Well, setting up the precedent for violence so the government can come in. They've got the camps or the contract for the camps that they're building. Round them all up. Haul them away. Deport some, of course. And then we've lost our Constitution. Civil liberties are suspended. And we're going to be next.
You don't think that the effect of the demonstrations was positive?
Do I think it was positive? No, I don't think it was positive. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. When people saw Mexican flags being waved in the street, what happened? There was a big backlash. They got outraged. They got upset.
Well,
and they're screaming for the government to take action.
Well, it's interesting to think what most people, whatever that means, think about it. When I saw it, I thought it was very positive. They were all very peaceful. The only violence that I know of was just completely peripheral.
Oh, you know, and I agree with you. And I understand that people come here because they want a better life. They don't want to live in a hellhole. They want to come here. They want to work. That's true. But you have to look behind the scene. Who's promoting these people?
Well, like Mexico and Guatemala and El Salvador aren't hell holes, but they can be economic hell holes, and that's due to U.S. policy. A number of U.S. policies I could name, but most recently NAFTA.
NAFTA,
which, for example, wiped out all the corn farmers in Mexico. And they can't sell their corn because they're being undersold by U.S. corporations.
You're correct. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. That's what I'm saying. And when you look at who's behind all this, it's the big corporations, the mega corporations. George Bush fronts for them. It's a fraud. The whole thing is a fraud.
What, George Bush being fraudulent?
No. Couldn't
okay.
be.
I appreciate your calling.
Thank
you.
Thank
you. Number to call 503-231-8187. Hi, you're on the air.
No. Hi. I am.
You are. We have a bit of a delay, so if you turn down your radio, it'll be less confusing.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
We're proud of that. We finally got a delay loop going after years and years. So now if one of us says, sneezes or something, we can take care of it.
This is a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad to be part of it. Somebody mentioned the Christic Institute.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
You? Well, are we on the air now?
Yes, we are on the air.
Oh, dear. Well, we gave a room, board, and shelter to one of the Christic Institute lawyers during the Silkwood trial in Oklahoma City, and I have a great deal of sadness that the Reagan administration finally put them out of business.
Yeah, they really attacked them with the
federal courts to just decimate their funding. But that's not what I'm calling about. Guess what? I have three great-grandchildren, and I have just discovered that 8 major religions have the golden rule as one of their essential principles, and I don't think we've given it a chance, and I think we need to put it up there as one of the high priorities of religion.
On 10 tons of granite.
Huh?
Why not?
And the most amazing thing was when I was downtown last week to go to a Women's International League for Peace and Freedom water meeting. They had a woman here from that's doing a lot of stuff about commoditizing water, which, you know, is kind of essential, too. anyway, one of the buildings in downtown Portland has the Golden Rule in the front of it. Do you want me to tell you which one?
Well, before you do, the CIA has on the front of it, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."
And then Harvard and Yale are big in Veritas and Lux et Veritas, too.
Yeah.
Well, I worked at Yale for several years, for 3. I know quite a bit about their Veritas.
Yeah.
Well, listen, but I really wanted to do something. I wanted to say this. One of the absolutely blessed events of my life in Portland, which has been sort of 4 years and sort of off and on 4 years, and I'm sort of an exile because I want to get back to Oklahoma for the 100th birthday to recognize the genocide, the unconscious genocide, attempted genocide of Native Americans. But anyway, what I wanted to say is that Paul Ehrlich, the biologist that writes with his wife, who's also a biologist,
mm-hmm.
he spoke at the First Congregational Church. And and he got the group's attention. The church was full. This was one of a series of environmental lectures.
Mm-hmm. What did he say?
Well, the first thing he said was, "We could learn a lot from the large apes. They resolve a lot of their conflicts with genital rubbing." Did you ever think you'd hear that from a church pulpit?
No.
You could have heard a pin drop. I mean, everybody was just kind of, you know, breathing. But the reason he said that was the tuba for to get our attention. And then the next thing he said was, what's really important to me today is we must always remember we are small group mammals.
Isn't that stunning?
I think it is worth.
Isn't that uncomfortable?
We need community, you know, which is why we need community radio. But we need community more than anything.
Yeah, but listen, I feel so the people here don't realize how lucky they are to have this community. You know, in Oklahoma, there's nothing even to think about this. You know, I mean, this even resembles this in any way.
Well, that's a shame.
And so this is. I just feel really thankful that I've, you know, shared as much as I've been able to share.
Well, thanks for calling in then.
Well, thank you for having your program. And by the way, I'm a member of Society of Professional Journalists. And I wonder if there are any other people that are interested in media enlightenment. Because a lot of the media are well-meaning, but they've just been kept ignorant by our cunning propaganda.
It is a problem at this point. I would say ignorance of participants in media, yeah, that's a big problem right now. Historical ignorance.
One of Eisenhower's speech writers, you know, he couldn't write speeches, but guess what they wrote? May I end with that?
Sure.
We seek victory not over any nation or people, but over ignorance, poverty, disease, and human degradation wherever they may be found. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's great words.
Yeah.
Then there was Eisenhower.
Well, it's a lot harder to do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for your call. I'm going to call 503-231-8187. Now, before I get to the next call, I wanted to continue on the thread. I was talking about slavery in the United States, and I'm talking about the Orleans Parish Prison, where all of these people are being kept, apparently. Unlike most county jails, according to dollarsandcents.org, the Parish Prison also has contracts to house state and federal prisoners, serving as a de facto overflow prison. They have one of the largest populations of any jail in the country, averaging nearly 7,000 inmates at any one time. And there's no reason for them to have that. That's the largest incarceration rate of any large city, 1,480 prisoners per 100,000 residents. Now, the reason for this is economic. This is why you can find it in dollarsandcents.org. They get money for each prisoner. And so there is a tremendous, they get, let's see, $22.39 per day for each local prisoner, $100,000 per day, and even more money to house federal prisoners. So there's a reason right now why there are so many people doing prison labor, yes, in New Orleans prison without a paper trail, some without being charged, others without being convicted, others have served out their sentence. A lot of them shouldn't be in there at all because their arrests were so petty. And this is going on right now for apparently thousands of people, and it needs to be brought into the news every day unless we just want to tolerate slavery in the United States. And isn't it funny? It's the black people they hit first, just like every other negative U.S. policy that I can think of. But I'll go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello?
Hi, you're on.
Yes, WETA, the public broadcasting station in Washington, D.C., they fund illegal, you know, they have all kinds of wonderful programming about how wonderful it is that we have all these illegal immigrants. But when it came to putting a day labor center across the street from WETA, they went to court to fight it because they don't want these illegal immigrants in their backyard. And the person who heads WETA is Sharon Rockefeller, who's Jay Rockefeller's wife. It goes back to the guy that called in about... Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, about the guy that called in about the Carnegie and Ford foundations funding all of the illegal immigration, like CASA and... And also, you don't ever mention that George Soros... Hello?
Hello.
That George Soros is the main funder of the Carlyle Group. You keep talking about the Carlyle Group, but he's one of your main pimps.
He's not the main funder of the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group
was a major funder of the Carlyle Group, one of the original founders. He's another one of those that wants to, you know, overrun the United States with everywhere else.
You've got me. I mean, I have to admit it now. My middle name actually is Rockefeller.
Well,
Teresa Rockefeller Mitchell, and I have my orders every week, which I come here, and I ignore these topics that you have frequently called in to bring up.
Well, you don't bring that up. Why don't you talk about George Soros?
And I think I'll go on to the next caller. The finances of the Orleans Parish Prison Empire are a mystery to local and state officials. In fact, the $75 million-plus annual budget presented to the City Council in 2005 was a meager 2 pages, the same length as, the OPP evacuation plan. Personnel expenditures, which totaled $39 million, were listed on a single line, and the sheriff didn't bother to break the figure down. That's how corrupt the organization is. The lack of accountability extends to prison labor. Orleans Parish prisoners working alongside roadways, erecting stands for, yes, Mardi Gras, setting Christmas lights for the city's celebration of the Oaks, or working at Halloween haunted houses along then common sites. In 1989, the Times-Picayune reported that private citizens and companies could hire prisoners to perform work at minimum wage. From these wages, the sheriff would deduct living expenses, travel expenses, support of the prisoner's dependents, any payment of the prisoner's debts, and any remaining money going to the prisoner. Recently, OPP built an aquaculture facility run entirely by prison labor to raise about 600 to 700 pounds of tilapia fish per year. Prison laborers are often used as political tools as well. This is going on right now in New Orleans. We're talking about slave labor. We're talking about mostly people of color. We're talking about, well, we're talking about a scandal that should be right up there in, if we had real news, alongside global warming, threat of war with Iran, and everything else that we just don't get to talk about. But this is the news you're not supposed to know, and if you'd like to comment, the number to call, 503-231-8187. There's a Dar Jamal complains in Truth Out that there's an ongoing war on truth in Iraq as well. And he quotes Lawrence of Arabia, stating that the reports from his time in 1920 were bogus as well. But I think we also have a caller. Let me just check on that. That would be the case. So, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Mitchell. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Hey, it's a local KVU corporate bashing program, right?
Yeah.
Why do you like to bash corporations, just out of curiosity?
They're totalitarian organizations, largely unaccountable, and they have taken They have taken a fraudulent position of personhood in the United States, and I do not tolerate totalitarian organizations. Go ahead.
But I own a corporation.
And
I employ 20 legal Hispanic families.
And you're a totalitarian.
Am I a totalitarian?
And let me explain why you're a tyrant. These people are creating wealth for you. They're not creating wealth for themselves. Oh, no, I'm not going to wait because this never gets to be said, and I'm going to say it whether you like it or not. Now, listen, you owe these people the full share of the work that they do. You do not deserve to receive any extra benefit. If you invested on an honest basis, you deserve to get your investment back. And that's it, buddy. You do further work, you should get paid for your work, and so should they. What you are is a capitalist. You say because you paid the money that you get money forever from a class of people who are not as equal as you. That is totalitarian.
Crash.
Hello?
When's our economy going to crash?
What's trashed?
When is our economy going to crash?
Well, I don't know.
You said that a month ago. How do you know how much I pay my employees?
You don't. They're employees. That means you pay them a wage, which is based on the standard of desperation in the community. I just explained what's wrong with that, but you weren't listening.
I paid them double what minimum wage is.
Okay, you don't want to get it, and you ain't going to get it, but I'll go on to the next caller. Thanks for calling in. And, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Hey, talking about putting refugees in little prison camps and stuff. You there?
Yep, I'm here.
You remember when? Remember when the Mariel refugees came?
Yeah.
And I guess the U.S. government, Clinton was governor of Arkansas, but they were all put in some kind of detention camps in Arkansas for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Kind of not really remembered very much these days. But anyway, that's what happened to them.
I assumed they were in Florida. I didn't realize they were taken to Arkansas.
Yeah, that's where they were. But they were put in these army bases, you know, detention camps. Of course, Haitians still are. So anyway, there's a precedent for it.
yeah, there is. You know, there's the Japanese detention camps. And as they were saying when they were talking about the nuclear bombing of Iran, we did it in Japan.
Oh,
so I think I'll just leave it hanging with that. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Time is approaching 10 a.m. Stay tuned for more of the Incomparable Radio Zine.
Well, I can't get enough of that theme. Coming up next, it's a pilot program of anti-war poetry called Roadside Bomb. They'll focus on the parallels between World War I and the Iraq War, as shown through the work of Siegfried Sassoon. And the poets are here. And after that, at 10:30, Julie Bernard hosts Art Focus. Her guest is Brian Costello of PICA, the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. At 11 on Democracy Now, hear about a lawsuit filed by the families of four private security contractors killed in Fallujah in March 2004. They are charging Blackwater USA with fraud and wrongful death. And now that pilot program, Roadside Bomb.